everybody. Welcome back to the Misfits and Mysteries podcast. It's your weekly podcast where we talk about everything from psychology and history to aliens and cryptids and everything in between. We are your hosts, Emmy
and Steve.
So today for everyone, we have a super special guest on. It's Kian from the podcast Wide Atlantic Weird. It's an Irish podcast about why people believe in weird things. It gives a critical look of cryptids, UFOs, and conspiracies. So welcome, Kian. Thank you so much again for joining.
Yeah, cool. It's super nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I know that you're usually drinking a beer during your episodes, but it's 10 a.m. here in New York, so we're with our coffee instead. But
yeah, I mean,
no, it's about 3 here, so I'm not that decrepit.
I'm a big fan of your podcast, especially because I don't know anything about Irish folklore or anything, and you guys have like the best names. I love how you pronounce Boily Rechty. I think that's like the funniest thing.
Boily. That's in England, though. That's a British.
I know it's England, but I just love how like you pronounce it. It makes me so happy to hear.
How would an English person say it? Boily. They tend to swallow their R's, so like they.
Hold up. The haunted fans keeps turning on. I'm just going to turn my lights off.
That combined with your video feed is giving a very Paranormal Activity sort of vibe.
Yeah, I was thinking that. First thing I thought, I was like, shit, my camera's not working today. This looks just like a Paranormal Activity movie.
Kian, so do you want to start off by just telling us how you got into exploring weird phenomena?
Yeah, I liked all that stuff when I was a kid. I think like most people, I trained in university in science and zoology. So I definitely got out of it for a long time. And, you know, I had this sort of like, well, look, a lot of this stuff probably isn't real. I was being trained in a sort of a scientific mindset and it dropped out of my interest for a long time. And I don't know, I came back around to it. I think a lot of people, once they get to a certain age, they get a nostalgia for stuff they liked when they were younger. My brother, who comes on my show very often, he's now got his doctorate in political science, but he loves talking about wrestling as much as he likes talking about political science. Mm-hmm. And he listens to like podcasts. He listens to like 3-hour episodes about wrestling. I think the internet allows us to indulge in our hobbies to a degree that we couldn't before. So I started looking up these old, you know, myths and legends that I liked when I was a kid about monsters and ghosts and stuff. And I was like, wow, there's like way more information about this stuff than I ever knew when I was a kid. Cause I just had these books where there'd be like a half page chapter on each thing. And that's all I thought there was available. But now you can look into this stuff and find out where it comes from and what the, you know, primary sources were and kind of how it's been spun over the years, which is what I like to do, really. So,
In terms of promoting another episode, I also really liked your Hellfire Club one. I mean, that's another thing that's very uniquely, I'd say, like UK or European. I don't think we really have stuff like that here.
Well, I mean, late in the episode. So the Hellfire Club is a place in Dublin where it's like a historical hunting lodge from the 1700s on a hill called Montpelier Hill, just looking over Dublin City. And with a colleague, just before Dublin locked down, it was like the last possible, that midnight, we had to be out of the county and back down to Cork in the south where I live. You say it's a specifically European thing, but late in the episode, and just the sort of things we started talking about, the sort of myths and legends about the place, which is that supposedly it was kind of young bucks about town, you know, these kind of rich, idle and debaucherous. All the stories that were told about them were that they were, you know, devil worshippers and blood drinkers and stuff. And I was like, well, actually, that bit of folklore continues today because, you know, you've got the Satanic Panic in the 80s. Mm-hmm. You've got the Dennis Wheatley stuff in the 1930s and 50s, which I've covered on the show. He was an English writer who kind of popularized the notion of, you know, what we think of as quote unquote Satanists now. And then you've got the QAnon stuff. It's the same ideas.
I guess it is. Yeah, the QAnon stuff is scary, especially because we have a Q person in the Senate now. I forgot. That's interesting. I mean, we don't really talk about politics. We don't want to alienate anyone, but I think it's a problem. And I hope everyone agrees that's a problem, that there's someone who believes in QAnon in our Senate, because QAnon is bullshit. just the fact that people think that Trump is saving the world and that man somehow hasn't been blabbing about it. I don't care what you think about him, but he cannot anything good he does or he thinks he's doing, he doesn't shut up about. There's no way he's secretly saving the world.
Yeah. Well, on top of that, there's actually there's been research. As a conspiracy of any kind gets bigger, how many people are required to keep silent?
Yes, there's a
bunch of numbers for this, you know, for example, the moon landing, like over how many years, how many people would need to be involved. Folks who believe will then say, well, actually people have come, you know, there have been, you know, whistleblowers, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it depends on your take on it, but mathematically it's fairly unlikely that something that size would be.
Yeah, it would be real difficult to keep that secret.
Yeah, not impossible. And things have happened in the past, but, mm-hmm. you know. I err on the side of caution with this stuff.
I'm not a big fan of it. I think it's real risky. All right, so let's hop into our episode. So today we're going to be talking about some lake monsters, or I guess just aquatic monsters in general in both New York and Ireland, because turns out there's actually a surprising tradition in New York of monsters. Like there's Old Greeny, Champ, and Lake Champlain. There's also this two-headed bass that people claim exists. Which probably is real, and that's probably a genetic mutation. Someone definitely did catch that at one point. And then sewer gators, which are a New York City phenomenon that's a little bit less cryptid and more real than you'd believe.
Yeah, so Kian, do you want to jump into telling us a little bit about what there is in Ireland?
Yeah, absolutely. So sort of lake monsters, like the history of sea monsters is longer and goes back to maybe the 19th century, but mm-hmm. like lake monsters take off in the mid 20th. Loch Ness becomes a thing really in the 1930s. You have the what's called the Spicer sighting, which is like the originator. And people like to look back in history and say that there's other stuff that might have been linked to this. But from a cultural point of view, 1930s is when it takes off. And about 20 years later, we start to get lots of really interesting cases, mostly in the west of Ireland. So in the 1950s, 1954, we have a sighting in County Galway on the west coast in a place called Loch Fada, which is Long Lake. But hilariously, all of these stories are in lakes that are really, really, really tiny. They're all like 100 meters by 100 meters, and they're just glorified ponds. And there's literally stuff written by like groups of, you know, monster hunters who have heard these stories and traveled sometimes from Britain and from Canada, and they get to Galway and they see the lakes and they're like, what? This is tiny. But the story goes, a witness by the name of Georgina Carberry and three friends are cycling around this lake, Loch Fada, and they take a boat to go fishing. And this is from Dick Rayner's website, who does a lot of good writing on this stuff. He says, by late in the afternoon, they'd succeeded in securing a number of trout. The group decided to set the boat ashore along a finger of land that splits the lake in half. As they were settling down with their tea, one of them pointed out an object moving from an island in the middle, and they presumed at first this was a man swimming, but soon it became apparent it was too big to be human. The mysterious object was approaching them at a leisurely speed. As it began to draw close, concern arose within the party, and when it gets close to them, they see that there were a great mouth, two big humps, and a forked tail. Pretty good.
Spooky.
This is pretty good. And they describe the animal's skin as wormy or creepy. They're interviewed by this guy later on called Ted Holliday, who's kind of a British guy who's very mixed up in the hunt for Loch Ness at this time. He was a big name in UK cryptozoology. There's a wonderful video. I might send it to you if you fancy putting it in your notes.
I'm interested.
The Irish broadcaster RTE from the late 60s. And there's literally an expedition to these lakes, these lots of little tiny lakes in the west of Ireland and Galway, where a lot of these kind of big names in like British monster hunting, people like Ivor Newby and Lionel Leslie and Ted Holliday, who are all these kind of old-fashioned upper crust British monster hunters. They're all like puffing pipes and wearing khaki and saying, oh, you know, jolly, jolly good old boy. There's the beast, I say. It's marvelous stuff. And
incredible.
It's really, really worth a look. But lots of these little lakes, especially Loch Fada and another one called Lake Nahuan, get a reputation in the 50s and then in the 60s for these sightings of, they're often called like a water horse or a horse eel. These are kind of local folkloric names for any sort of water-based mythological. Prior to the 1950s, they're a lot more folkloric, I would say, than crypto. But, you know, society changes, culture changes. You know, prior to this, they would have been interpreted by locals, I think, in a sort of a folkloric. It's like seeing a kelpie. It's like seeing a fairy, you know? Yeah. Whereas after the 1930s, you have this concept of, no, there were mysterious animals hidden. in remote places. And then people start saying, well, what if they're, you know, physical beings? What if, and then once you have the idea of the Loch Ness Monster, which takes off in the 30s, people are saying, well, you know, you've got the common idea is that it's a leftover plesiosaur. This fellow, Ted Holliday, interestingly, believed for a long time that it was some kind of giant invertebrate, like a gastropod, something like a giant slug.
Oh, wow. That'd be crazy.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, so he's a really weird guy, and he wrote loads of books. John Keel and the Mothman Prophecies?
Yeah. I've actually watched it, but I've seen it. I've heard about it.
He's a bit like that in that he has this idea. He eventually comes to this idea that like all monster sightings, including the Loch Ness Monster, which he supposedly saw himself many times, he comes to this idea that they're all sort of spiritual or psychological. They're not physical. Because after so many years of like people seeing these oversized animals in tiny lakes, and it just doesn't seem to make sense. So he comes to a more holistic understanding of them, which is a bit like what John Keel did, you know, about 10 years later.
So out of curiosity, in Ireland, do you guys have huge fish that could be mistaken for these things, like sturgeon or like muskie, like we have in
the usual explanation would be like things like otters. So it would be more otters. Mammalian.
Yeah. I know in a lot of these Great Lakes where like these monsters are seen. So like a lot of the explanations like a sturgeon. Like sturgeon can get fucking massive. They can get like 20 feet long. They're real big. Their backs stick out of the water. There are a lot of like legends, like Native American legends, even in Alaska and stuff about sturgeon. And then muskie can get real long and they have razor sharp teeth and they're mean. I mean, I imagine if you ever fished in Canada, everyone tries to catch a muskie. They call them the fish of a thousand casts because they're they're so hard to get.
I did a little ice fishing in Minnesota once, and that was one of the ones they talked about. It's certainly possible, but over here it's more the larger things that tend to be mistaken would be otters and things like that. So again, not huge, but
yeah,
if you're keyed up to see something, that's really important, you know. If a place has a reputation for an animal and then you see something slightly odd that you can't identify, it doesn't even have to be that strange, I think, before.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of fishing, especially with quarantine. And we have a house up in Vermont. So, because I was unemployed for a while. So I'd just go up there. I'd go in the woods and I'd fish like 12 straight hours in the woods. And it's you're trying to catch like even just like a little pickerel, which is just like a baby pike, basically. Even just watching how those things move and how vicious they are, I could see you seeing like a big one and then your mind running wild. Like you're alone in the middle of the woods, like a couple miles away from like your car. Maybe you're just getting a little deranged, you're hungry or something, and you just sort of blow everything out of proportion. But like even the little ones are vicious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
In terms of the timeline too, what's interesting to me is you said this started around like the 1930s.
So in the UK, so the Loch Ness Monster first gets media attention in 1933. And the earliest Irish reports I find that kind of with that happen in the 50s and the 60s. And that's kind of when the UK Loch Ness Monster community, if you want to call it that, these group of, you know, enthusiasts and investigators start coming over to Ireland en masse to basically their idea as well. Loch Ness is huge. It's something like 27 miles long, whereas these lakes are tiny. So they think, well, we're more likely to get something in the small lake, and they're literally covering the entire lake with nets, and they're actually dynamite and stuff into it to try and shake something and like shooting large weapons into the water to try and stir something up. Because these are peaty lakes. They're, as Loch Ness is itself, very dark, and you can't really see anything moving inside it. So,
do you guys have salmon over there?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I don't really know where salmon live besides Alaska. One thing I just thought of is like king salmon can get over 100 pounds in the wild. If you have salmon there, you have a king salmon, you might blow. You might think that's something else. That's gigantic. You're like, this thing shouldn't be this big.
Yeah.
Like a few people a year actually in Alaska get pulled to their death off boats fishing for king salmon because they're like 150 pounds and they don't eat you or anything, but the water is so cold you just get hypothermia and die.
What's your favorite like lake monster photograph? You know, there's a small number of very famous ones.
I mean, honestly, it has to be just the classic. I know it's they've come out and said it's a fraud, but the classic Loch Ness monster. Just learning about that when I was a kid, seeing the photo, is just so cool.
Yeah.
There's a famous champ one, isn't there? That's very clear. And
yeah, there is a famous champ one.
Yeah.
I like that picture.
And actually recently, besides the photos, they've come out with this couple who are both cryptozoologists did a study, and they found some kind of echolocation in Lake Champlain that they're using as evidence of champ. And some people think it may actually be a whale because the lake is absolutely massive, but interesting too, just in terms of echolocation, like what could be causing that.
Did you know about a similar
case here closer to me in 2003, I think, in County Kerry, next county over, in the lakes of Killarney. There was something large, like 80 feet long or something, was picked up by, you know, some sort of echolocation. And again, I don't think it was ever explained, but I haven't heard much more else about it since. It was a group of like fishery scientists of some sort. So I've been looking it up, but I've not seen anything else since.
That's really interesting. I mean, going along with the fishery thing, I was watching this great documentary on CuriosityStream. I try and plug them every week so they eventually sponsor us.
Worth a shot.
called Whale Wisdom. And there's an interesting thing where these humpback whales, they've learned that they can get an easy meal by just eating baby trout at these trout fisheries, or baby salmon it was, right? So there's this one they had on video that basically just hangs out outside the fishery and just causes mayhem. Like, it'll go underneath and like scare them out, and then it just swallows large batches of the babies. And then because it's a protected species, no one can do anything about it.
Yeah.
That's the way to do it, isn't it? Get yourself protected first.
Yeah. Get yourself protected and then just
free reign.
Troll the farm.
Yeah, exactly. I like it. So this is the legend of Champ, who is in Lake Champlain. And Lake Champlain is a huge lake. It's 125 miles long in kind of New York, Vermont, and Canada. And interestingly enough, the first sighting of Champ was in 1819. That's why I was surprised by your timeline.
Yes.
Over in Ireland, I feel like there's just a lot more history over there. So 1918 is pretty early. But since then, there's been about 300 reputable, quote unquote, reputable sightings of Champ. And the first sightings, this was written in a newspaper. He's a long snake-like body with a flat horse-like head. So as you said, Kian, kind of like a eel horse combo, and being roughly the size of a yacht. So
pretty big.
And some people believe this is actually a type of water dinosaur that lived over 200 million years ago and is kind of stuck around. So, you know, as I was chatting about earlier, there was this couple who are both cryptozoologists who have started tracking the sounds from Lake Champlain, and they found one recording that can kind of be discarded as a beluga whale that has some way found its way into the lake. But the second recording they believe to be Champ. And we can include that in our episode notes too.
Cool.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Check that out.
Yeah. And it's become kind of so popular that there's signs all over Lake Champlain about Champ, and people actually go there to try to look for him. So what they actually think might have happened is, you know, these cryptozoologists, the theory is that because the Atlantic Ocean used to be connected to Lake Champlain, perhaps he was able to kind of swim his way in, a few of them, and have sort of quietly been in this huge, deep, dark lake for the last 10,000 years, probably, which seems like a long time to never find one, but who knows?
Yeah. Are there like Native American stories about Champ, or is this just like it just popped up in 1819?
It seems like 1819 was around the first one.
That's so really fascinating.
It's worth bearing in mind as well. There's a separate tradition, an older tradition of sea monsters, right? Mm-hmm. And there's some great from about that time, and there's some well-known cases in the early 19th century. So I'd consider it like a separate cycle of stories, but there's no reason why you know, that couldn't have been a source here, because it depends on how it's described. I mean, you're making it sound more like the contemporary Lake Monsters, though, which is interesting. I do like timelines, because I like to try and trace the origins.
Interesting to me. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I always find new things. I'm always finding new stuff. So until recently, I didn't trace the Irish ones until earlier than the 1960s. And now I'm finding earlier ones. And sometimes it does throw out my ideas, and I have to be open to that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, what's interesting about Greeny too is... So what I think is interesting about that is that legend goes back a really long time and is very similar. And what's interesting is it has its origins in Native American folklore. A fact about Greeny that I thought was incredible is that there is a case, like a sighting in January 5th of 1897, and that marked the 69th consecutive year with one or more credible Greeny sightings. Cool. In Lake Cayuga. I don't know how to pronounce it, but
yeah, it's Cayuga. I think.
Cayuga. It's like Cayuga and Seneca. And there's this myth that there is underground tunnels connecting them, but apparently it's absolutely impossible for that to happen geologically, but people still think that. But it's interesting that in two of the, is Lake George, it's not a Finger Lake, is it?
No, it's not.
Is it a Great Lake? What's its deal? I forget.
What's a Finger Lake?
Oh, so we have Finger Lakes. Are they all in New York, or they go New York to Michigan? I forget.
I believe they're all in New York.
They're all in New York. There's five of them. It's Lake Seneca, Lake Cayuga. I don't remember the rest of them, if I'm being honest. But so Seneca and Cayuga are the two biggest, and they're each almost about 40 miles long and about 1 to 3 miles wide. And their depths are hundreds of feet deep. Mm-hmm. The Finger Lakes are like sort of in the Adirondacks, right?
Oh, cool. Yeah. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Is it the shape of them? Is that why they're called the fingers?
Yeah. There's like five fingers, and they're sort of, they're skinny. So they're really long, and like, they're only about 3 miles wide, and there's five of them. And so Seneca and Cayuga are huge, and people believe that you could like get between them. One of the more interesting stories that I found, I mean, there's two really interesting ones about Old Greeny. There was this kid who got his arm broken by what appeared to be an eel. Right? Like a massive eel, but I never recovered it. And then the story that's really fascinating about Old Greeny, and so these lakes aren't that far apart. How far would you say, Emmy? Like 100 miles, 50 miles?
Maybe not even that far.
Maybe not even. Yeah, they're in the same region of New York. So it's interesting that we have two lakes in similar areas. So this is over by Ithaca, actually, Lake Cayuga.
Yeah, there, I think it's more western New York. And
yeah,
there's actually 11 of them, but there's five big ones, I think, and I'm looking right now. It's Cayuga, Seneca, Cayuga, which is different than Cayuga, Canandaigua, and Honai. I've never heard of that one.
I have neither. I mean, they're all named after Native American folklore, I think. So what's interesting about Old Greeny is this is the most interesting story. It occurred July 14th, 1899 on Seneca Lake. And even though most of the sightings were on Cayuga, this one happened in Seneca. So there was a steamboat named, oh my God, I'm going to slaughter this name. I'm so sorry. Oti Etiani, I think. She starts traveling to North Geneva. So North Geneva is where like Ithaca and Cornell are. And around 7 p.m., so this is the summer, so 7 p.m. in New York, it's going to be bright until like 9, so they had a clear line of sight. On the telescope, the guy who was driving the ship saw what appeared to be an overturned boat, right? So they got within 100 feet of it, and then apparently this thing looked at them and flashed its teeth. So the captain's like, you know what we're going to do? Instead of running away from this thing that's like 50 feet long, we're going to collide with it and kill it.
Ram it.
So that's exactly what they did, because apparently they're swimming slowly and they collided with it and killed it, which the weird thing is they never recovered the body, even though they sent a team. And they claim there's a lot of credible people. There was like the police chief, a bunch of credible people, and a geologist. I love how the most credible scientist they had was someone who's not familiar with animals at all.
Yeah, that happens quite a bit actually in these stories.
When the geologist went to retrieve it, he said that the creature was at least 25 feet long with a tail that was tapered until about 5 feet at the end when it brought in like a whale's tail. And it had a long triangular mouth with two rows of teeth like a shark, but they were the size of sperm whale teeth. He said it weighed at least 1,000 pounds and its head was 4 feet long. And then let me pull up the exact description. So clearly the word horny meant something else back in 1800, but how this guy described it. Its body was covered with a horny substance, which was as much like the carapace of a tarrapin as anything else of which I know. The horny substance was brown in color and of greenish tinge. It's not as funny how he calls it a horny substance. But it's pretty funny. So one explanation for what this is as I was alluding to before with the muskie. So muskie have like razor sharp teeth. They're hyper aggressive and they can get quite big, not 25 feet long. They can probably get like 10, 15 feet. And they're known to be like on the surface. So it's very possible they saw a muskie. A lot of the story doesn't add up, but that's like the prevailing theory. They're kind of serpent-like. There are other stories like this in Canada, ancient tradition too, with like the Inuits, where they believe that there's like a serpent, but it's clearly just a very large like muskie. Like they've been able to produce the evidence. So that's my theory of what Greenie is, but I think it's really fascinating. So Greenie is portrayed more as like a eel sea monster type creature. And I guess is Champ more like a plesiosaur?
That's what it seems like.
Yeah. That's interesting how we have two different types.
And absolutely. And there was, do you know Bernard Heuvelmans? He's like one of these guys who's writing about cryptozoology in the 50s when it's kind of forming as a field. Mm-hmm. And he kind of points out that to him, there's something like 9 different types of sea serpents. So he goes mm-hmm. through all the reports and he tries to sort them based on their physical appearance.
Yeah.
And early on, like in the 50s, I think he's got something like 9 different categories, and he does whittle them down over the years. So now, you know, 20 years later, he's writing books where he says maybe there's only 4 or 5. But mm-hmm. yeah, within the cryptozoological literature, there is absolutely this idea that there's more than one kind of creature, and that the slug-like ones aren't necessarily the same as the water horse ones, aren't the same as the plesiosaur type ones. And interesting to hear, for the first time I've heard anyway, you're telling a story where it sounds like it's almost like a turtle or a tortoise type thing. You said like a terrapin with a shell. That's interesting. Exactly. I've never heard that as a hypothesis, because mm-hmm. they're always trying to say, well, is it a plesiosaur, or in Ted Holliday's case, is it some kind of ancient invertebrate?
He called it a horny terrapin.
Let's not forget that.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. The one thing that's weird, though, is like everyone thinks it's probably a giant muskie. A muskie is really fast. There's no way in hell a steamboat rammed a muskie. They're also highly mobile. So that's like the one that doesn't quite add up.
Yeah.
Maybe it was
what
dead.
Was the story? There was a story about a kid losing an arm to a monster? What
broken arm, yeah.
So, a broken arm. Okay, yeah. I thought you said he lost his arm.
No, he didn't lose his arm. He broke his arm to what appeared to be an eel. But freshwater eels are vicious. I don't know if you ever watched the show River Monsters.
Yeah, I have, yeah.
So he had this episode where he was in New Zealand, because they have all these legends of giant eels that like used to exist. And even the little eels will rip you apart if they're hungry enough. So like it's not out of the question that if a freshwater eel got a bite of his arm, they have razor sharp teeth. It's not out of the question that it could have broken a bone of his, especially as a little kid.
How big are we talking? How big do they get?
Oh, they can get like 50 feet. Not in America, but like in New Zealand.
Okay.
Like a really old one, because here's the thing, they live like 100 years.
Yeah.
Like, they're not that heavy though, right? Because like, think about it. It's an eel that lives in the water, so it's not going to be that heavy, but they can grow really long and they have really razor sharp teeth. But yeah. So an eel is not out of the question. I mean, they also have, I think in Seneca is not attached to the ocean, right, Emmy?
No.
Lake George is though, right?
I think so.
No, because I think that there's like waterways there. Because I know that they found bull sharks in Lake George before.
Okay.
I have another little story here from County Meath, which is kind of in the middle of the country in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And this is super stereotypical because it's a sighting by three priests. It says, this is from a Canadian cryptozoological organization called the BCSCC, which I've looked high and low on this page to find out what that stands for. It's a very old website. I'm presuming it's British Columbia Society of Crypto something. So they say in 1960, so kind of at about the period where most of the interest is in Ireland. In 1960, three priests were indulging in a bit of relaxation at Loch Ree in County Meath when their enjoyable afternoon of fishing and stimulating conversation came to an abrupt end. Father Richard Quigley, Matthew Burke, and Daniel Murray almost dropped their rods in shock when one of the priests spotted a large black animal swimming up the loch a mere 100 yards away. For a second, the creature sank below the surface and then rose again in the form of a loop. A quick, approximate measurement by the priest left them with the impression that the animal was 6 feet long from its head to the end of the coil. The head and neck were only 18 inches long compared to some of the other animals spotted in nearby lakes. Hardly a giant, but unusual enough to be distinguished from local known inhabitants like otters. The animal was certainly something the priests were completely unfamiliar with. The subsequent testimony of the three men of the cloth was covered in the local newspapers and treated with a fair degree of respect in view of their lucid and straightforward retelling of the event. I will point out here that it would be unusual for newspapers in Ireland in 1960 not to take the views of three priests
right.
with a lot of respect.
Did they ever figure out what they thought it was?
No, there's no kind of cap to this one, really. So they take their story to a Colonel Harry Rice, who's a local gentleman, I suppose. And he has written about stories of monsters in a book called Thanks for the Memory. And he had always thought of this monster as being just a legend until he heard this story from the three priests. So It's an interesting time because it's like something that had always been a more of a folkloric thing is becoming more of a crypto thing. That's what really interests me.
That's very fascinating.
Yeah.
So do you want to learn about New York City Gators?
I do.
Oh, yes.
Okay. So this one is pretty close to home. So my mom is from Queens. My uncle grew up in Manhattan. So this is when this stuff was going down. It's like back then there was like no laws in the 60s. Or actually they're born at the beginning of the 60s. So it's like the 70s, right? I'm not going to pretend my mom's that old. But so they were like growing up in New York City back then when things were like wild, you know? That was when the Bronx was burning. Manhattan wasn't that nice of a place yet. My great uncle has this beautiful giant apartment that he purchased in the Upper East Side that he purchased when New York City was like a shithole. So it's worth so much now, but like back then it was worth nothing. It was like Central Park wasn't a safe place. It's funny how it's changed. So
yeah,
the reason that this one's always been close to home is like, I know people, I mean, I've heard stories my whole life of people having pets. They couldn't take care of them anymore. Flush them down the toilet. It's like the gator will live in the sewer fine. And I remember in Central Park, I think it was around 2000, 2001, somewhere around there. I talk about it in here. There was a caiman in a river in Central Park. And there was a whole big thing that they had to remove it. And I remember it being on the news. So it sort of reinforced it. And I remember a lot of like cartoons and stuff talking about sewer gators. I mean, Killer Croc from Batman is literally a sewer gator that mutated. Yeah.
You're making me think of like the old Turtles cartoon where like New York is portrayed and the old Turtles movies.
Ninja Turtles. Yeah.
Cause like New York is portrayed as this hyper violent place. And there's all this stuff about mutated animals living in the sewers. Yeah.
I mean, in the
80s, timeline is right. That's the early 90s.
Early 90s, 80s, New York City was a really violent place. Times Square did not have a M&M store like it does now. You used to not want to go down Times Square. That's where like rings were as a bad place. So I actually found this article by the New York Times where they broke down every article written about sewer gators. And someone wrote this in February of 2020. So like, this is the most up-to-date thing.
Nice.
Let's just start where there's a myth that sewer gators are fake. And it's sort of true, sort of not. Let's just say that.
I've always believed that. I thought it was a total myth because it's always in books about urban legends.
It's interesting because there's no such thing as mutant sewer gators. That's a total myth. But what's fascinating is that even to this day, they rescue about one gator a year in New York City.
I'm interested. Who has a gator as a pet?
I don't know, but it was.
And it's letting it go.
The first reported sewer gator occurred in 1907 in Kearney, New Jersey, which is about 12 miles outside of Midtown, right? So that's like New York City metropolitan area. And so this guy, Charles Gids, he was a superintendent of the Kearney Street Street Department. He was cleaning out the sewer when one of his workmen was like, hey, what's this strange object in the water? And he went to pick it up and it bit him. It turned out it was a baby crocodile that it just nipped him because it was a baby, but a crocodile bit him, right? Turns out the gator was this pet of this guy named John W. Roche, and his gator escaped, and he was really happy when his alligator was returned to him.
In those days, they would give it back to you. That's
yeah,
amazing.
Yeah.
He gave it back
here
to
you
him.
Go.
It's like, hold, take better care.
You weirdo, keeping gators.
Yeah.
So, and New York City apartments are so small, too.
That was, but this is also 1907, so it's different.
Still.
Was he keeping it in a bath? Like,
I think so. Yeah, that's what they keep them in bathtubs. So then there wasn't another sewer gator or sewer gator attack until 1932. There was an alligator sighting in the, you know where the Passamaquoddy River is in New Jersey?
I don't.
So you have the Hudson River and then Manhattan here. And then the other side bordering another area of like, there's a bunch of rivers, right? Have you ever been to New York?
I have not. No.
Okay, so there's
you don't have the map memorized in your head, Keon.
Well, like I'm standing in here for everybody who's not New York.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
It's more than just me.
We all need
orientation here.
I grew up outside the city, so I know it. So like, you have the Hudson, which is the big disgusting one. There's the Hudson. They have the big disgusting one, which is the East River, which runs along Brooklyn, and then you have the Passamaquoddy River, which sort of branches off of the Hudson and goes into Jersey. Okay. So basically there are alligator sightings there, which prompted a bunch of, so 1932 was a big year for sewer gators. So the Passamaquoddy River, so there's a big hunt for them there. Then a few weeks later in Tuckahoe, New York and Bronxville. So those are both in Westchester. Bronxville is maybe 15 minutes from where I live now. Tuckahoe is maybe 20. And they're like right next to each other. Two boys brought back a dead alligator that was just swimming in the Bronx River. And they claimed that there were at least two or three more. So the police went on a wild goose chase and then called it off when they realized that the boys just found someone's dead pet and pulled a prank on them. Oh. But it still means that someone's pet had gotten out and they found it. So there was actually a gator in the Bronx River.
Oh my God.
And then 1934 is when mail order gators started. Do you know how cheap it was to order a live gator? It was $1.50 plus 25 cents for shipping.
How did they ship them in a box?
I guess, yeah.
This is when they're young, I presume.
Yeah, these are baby gators.
I can't imagine they had like overnight shipping.
Yeah, no, it wasn't overnight shipping for sure. And then, so during the 1934, it was also common practice to go to Florida on vacation and then just pick up a baby alligator from the wild and bring it as a souvenir home. And then what these people would do is they're like, uh-oh, this alligator gets fucking massive. I can't keep my bathtub anymore. I need to take a bath. So then
like, what, you didn't think of this earlier?
No, seriously.
Like,
then they either put them down the toilet or just dump them in the sewer or release them. And then, so also, there is
happier in the sewer than in the bathtub.
Yeah. And there's an alarming amount of stories of the alligators escaping, which is crazy because they have no arms or legs. I mean, sorry, they have legs. They have no arms. I hope they have legs.
They're not like velociraptors. They can't open doors.
They can't open doors. Yeah. No, they can't do that. So then 1935, a year later, this is like the quintessential sewer gator, like proof. There's actual video of it or pictures of it. Like they caught this thing. This is actually the first real true sewer gator. February 9th, 1935, there was a couple teens in East Harlem. They spotted an alligator down a storm drain and they lassoed it with a clothesline and brought it up. And when it snapped at them, they beat it to death with shovels, which is kind of mean, but I get why they did that. And the gator was 8 feet long, 125 pounds. And it was living in the storm drain. And they speculate that it escaped from a steamer in the East River that was supposed to deliver it to the Bronx Zoo and swam up an outflow pipe into Harlem.
And question.
Was out in the sewer.
So, I think the classic urban legend story is that they're living in the sewers and breeding, and they've been there for generations. So is there any evidence of breeding?
No, that story comes up later.
Oh, good.
So it'd be impossible for gators to, outside the Bronx Zoo or the Central Park Zoo, it'd be impossible for gators to live here naturally, because in the winters, especially in the 30s, it would get, it gets below freezing, so they would die.
Okay.
But their sewer gators are partially true, which I found interesting. So then in 1937, there were two Brooklyn gators. So the first, a barge captain in 1937, a barge captain pulled a 4'8" gator out of the East River by lassoing it. It was just in the river hanging out. And,
lasso.
Yeah. I don't know why these That's guys impressive. All, like, what I'm really impressed by is in the 30s, everyone knew how to lasso, apparently, because like that's how they caught all these.
Why were they even like carrying a lasso going down the street? What were they hoping to bump into? Like,
that's a really good question. I don't know. if I could interview them, someone who was there, I'd be like, why the hell do you have a lasso? But they're probably dead at this point. And then a week later, a 2-foot alligator crawled out of a trash can on a Brooklyn subway platform because someone just dumped it there, and a police officer had to tackle it and close its mouth up. So a lot of these gators, they didn't kill. They just like gave them to the Bronx Zoo. I don't really know what the stats are on this, but there seems like there's a good chance that a lot of the Bronx Zoo's gators were just discarded sewer gators. Yeah. And then, so the sewer gator moved into popular culture in the 1950s when like, or gators. So this was interesting. So the first time that the thought that purchasing gators became really part of pop culture was in the 1957. There was an episode of Leave It to Beaver where Beaver and whatever the other person did purchased baby alligators. And that really popularized it. And then this is a fun piece of trivia that was in the article. So sewer gators became so widespread from the 50s to 70s that there was even a plot to a porno that came out in 1975 called Sue Prentice, Registered Nurse, which involves a unit of nurses treating a team of scuba divers returning from a gator hunting expedition in the New York City sewers.
Oh, wow.
So that's how deep this went. It went into pornography.
That's when you know you've made it.
Yeah, seriously.
Okay, so then the giant mutant gator didn't come into existence until 1980 when the horror film.
Yes.
It was a horror comedy film. I think it was called Gigantic Mutant Gator. It's about an alligator, a baby alligator that's flushed down the toilet in an unnamed city, which is clearly Manhattan, and becomes a gigantic killer gator after feeding on discarded lab rats injected with growth hormones. So the interesting thing about sewer gators is they're usually described as giant, mutant, and or albino, or all three.
Oh, albino because they're under the ground,
yeah,
right?
So the idea is that they're underground, so they don't get any pig color for their pigment. But this guy in 1982 was kind of a party pooper. His name was John T. Fallerty. So he was in charge of the sewers of New York. And he says he's seen rats, he's seen insects, he's strained fish, dead bodies, and even clubhouses for gangs, but never a gator.
Clubhouses for gangs?
Yeah. They'd hang out in the sewers, apparently.
Oh, my God.
Wow. I'm learning all kinds of things.
Yeah. And then, so they didn't say where this is, but I know exactly where it is because I live in Westchester. But there was a 2-foot alligator that was found swimming in a Westchester reservoir. So I'm fairly confident this was Valhalla, the Valhalla Reservoir. There was a 2-foot alligator swimming in it. And so the New York Department of Environmental Protection had to get the Bronx Zoo to come, and they had a expedition to catch the gator and bring it to the Bronx Zoo. That's about 20 minutes from where I live. So if it didn't get too cold, that gator would thrive there. There's a lot of fish, a lot of prey, a lot of humans to prey on as well. Mm-hmm. That gator would have done well for itself. Like, it could have been really bad.
So this was all happening because of like lax laws regarding exotic animals. I hesitate to ask because I've seen at least one episode of Tiger King, but like, are the laws now? Can people just buy whatever crazy animals they want?
Not in New York.
Every state?
Not in New York. No, New York's super strict. Yeah, New York's super strict now, but it's the 80s. It was the 80s. The mafia was running everything. New York was a shithole. It was on fire. Like, yeah. It was a different time. You can't own alligators now. I mean, people still have them illegally and release them. And they get rescued at least one or two a year in just New York City. But you can't get this stuff outside of, like, Chinatown.
In the UK, there's a cycle of legends about, you probably know this, about, like, giant cats, big cats.
Oh, yeah, I actually have heard of that. There's, like, panthers, right?
And, yeah, usually panthers. The standard explanation for them is that there used to be a thriving black market for, or rather not a black market, but just a market for exotic animals. But and the laws changed in the 1970s. They put in the Wildlife Act, and suddenly it's not okay to just have all these animals. So the people tend to say that they must have released a lot of them into the countryside, and that's why sightings of mystery animals started to happen at that time. But even my understanding is that even before that, it was seen as something that only like eccentric rich people did. So there was a trafficking of big cats largely and other exotic animals. But that was for these kind of rich muckety mucks who had private menageries in their house to show off to their rich friends.
It wasn't
like sending away for a dollar and getting an
alligator in the mail.
Would literally just have an alligator in their bathtub. Like it wasn't like they were rich. They were just like, oh, this bathtub's an alligator's home. And then they're like, it got too big for our bathtub. Let's dump it in the trash can or the sewer. Okay, so another fun thing is the New York City, I'm so upset they changed this, but New York City, their Department of Environmental Protection, their mascot, their t-shirts and stuff, their logo, was an alligator wearing sunglasses popping out of a sewer. You see their logo. I don't know why they ever changed that. Isn't that incredible?
That's brilliant.
Yeah. So then the gator sightings actually continued up until 2019. In 1997, a 4-foot alligator was pulled out of Casina Lake in Queens, which is really close to where my mom grew up. I actually know where that lake is. And then in 2001, a 2-foot-long caiman was caught in Central Park just swimming around. 2003, a 3-foot-long gator was found in Alley Pond Park in Queens, and they promptly named the alligator Alley Gator.
There you go.
Which I think is hysterical. And apparently in that one, the first thing the police said when they're interviewed is there's no evidence that this gator came from the sewers. It's the first thing they said before anything else to try and dispel that theory.
Yeah.
And then in 2010, a 2-foot-long crocodile, which aren't even native to America, was spotted under a car in Astoria, Queens.
Can you imagine just walking on the street, seeing it under your car?
I would be so scared. And finally, in 2019, the nonprofit Care Center of New York City, which runs the city's animal shelters, they've said that they've handled 5 gators in the past 2 years. And they claim that none of them came from the sewers, but we cannot know for sure. But that's the history of sewer gators. But yeah, basically people will just get pet gators and just flush them down the toilet when they got too big.
Nice.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, the wildlife laws are a lot different now in New York, especially. They're super strict, so that's good.
We see where that legend comes from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, they literally were in the sewers. It's just that they all got caught.
and I would wager that like most of them probably hadn't been there very long and were seen or caught shortly after.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, I love the element that they're albino because that implies that they've been there for generations.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
So they're saying that gators actually would not be able to survive very long in the sewers because first of all, they wouldn't get enough sunlight. So they would become immobile after a while and just die of not having energy. And there's an ample food source, but they're also saying that apparently rats aren't a good food supply for them. I don't really know why. They didn't really go into it in the article, but according to experts, it's not a great like supply of nutrients. I think they'd have to eat so many rats that it would just like...
There are some big rats in
New York. I know, but in the wild, a full-grown gator will eat like an entire deer, let's say.
Yeah.
That's like, what, like 40
that's
rats?
That's a lot of rats
to catch. And then it's like also it's just polluted enough that they wouldn't do well. There's also like rumors that sewer workers carry pistols just in case they encounter a gator, but apparently that's not true. I used to work for an environmental consulting company, so I can tell you for a fact that no government employees besides the police carry guns. I've had to work with pretty much all of them. They do not carry guns. I can tell you that for a fact.
They might need it for the rats anyways.
I know. Honestly.
Or the gators.
But you're better off with like a bat. You waste so many bullets on all the rats. Oh my God.
All right. Yeah.
All right.
Well, I think that seems like a pretty good stopping point.
Yeah. That was fun. I'll thank you for coming on.
Yeah, no, nice to be here.
Thank you so much, Keon. Yeah. And where can people find your podcast?
So my show is called Wide Atlantic Weird. You can find it in all the usual places, whatever your podcatcher is. And for my socials on Twitter, I'm at Strange Ireland, which was the name of my old show, but I haven't changed it out of nostalgia. And on Instagram, we're Wide Atlantic Weird Podcast. That's it.
All right,
so well, check it out. Awesome. Similar stuff, actually.
Yeah. I mean, you're actually one of the first podcasts I found on Twitter when we started, and I really enjoyed it. And I'm glad we finally got you on.
Yeah, nice to be here. So networking is always good fun. And
oh, yeah.
I'm learning a lot about New York sewers.
Yeah.
I needed to know.
I mean, this
more
is
than you thought you'd ever need to know, probably.
We're discussing, and we're thinking, like, we might want to, because we did sort of New York cryptids, which there aren't that many of them, surprisingly. Emmy and I were discussing possibly doing, just going forward for everyone to know, maybe like an episode a month where we do cryptids from each state. So if you live somewhere, please send us your cryptids. Because I'm from New York, I had never heard of Champ or Old Greeny. So, I mean, I imagine there's probably cryptids we're going to miss.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for joining everyone. And of course, as always, remember to tune in every Thursday for a new episode.
And we're back. That was an awesome interview with Keen from Wide Atlantic Weird. You guys should really check out his stuff. He's awesome. We're going to go on to his podcast at some point. We have a really cool topic picked out. And now we're going to get into our newest segment where each week we watch an episode of the great, great free on YouTube reality show from 2007, Kid Nation. And just a little overview for anyone who hasn't seen this before or doesn't know about it, which should be most of you because it's a very forgettable TV show. These adults thought it was a good idea to take 40 kids from across the country who are 8 to 15 years old, all different backgrounds, 8 to 15 years old, which is just insane, put them in an abandoned old West ghost town in New Mexico and have them create a society to live in. And it is insane. It is really funny. Oh, also, if you guys haven't seen this, please, I've tweeted the link out. It'll be in the episode description as well. Please, for the love of God, watch episode 1 and follow along. You don't want to miss this. It's pretty great.
Yeah.
All right. So right off the bat, they chose 4 kids who would be the leaders who flew in on a helicopter. Everyone else would take a fucking bus and drop in the middle of the desert.
Yeah. And the leaders are also kids.
Oh, yeah. Leaders are also kids. We have who are the leaders? Let's see. It was AJ, who is described as a genius because he's good at spelling.
Spelling bee.
You want a spelling bee, so he's a genius. We have... we have Mike. I fucking hate Mike.
Mike is really takes his role very seriously.
I know, and he's such a whiny little baby. I fucking hate Mike. Okay, Mike's also like 8. Just keep in mind, all the opinions I'm holding of these kids, they're like 8 years old. And I am an adult.
I think Madison.
Madison, yes, Madison.
He's a leader.
And then there's the one who's the girl from Georgia who looks like she should be Taylor Ann Dupree.
Yes, Taylor, yes.
She is 10 years old, and she has dance mom vibes like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she's the youngest leader, so she's
10,
she gets homesick, too.
Yeah, and just remember that we have 8-year-olds competing against 15-year-olds. So right off the bat, do you want to get started? What is your favorite, before they even get to town, Who's your favorite and least favorite character before they even get to town?
When they're on the bus?
Let's just say when they're walking, they have to carry the shit. Remember to carry all their supplies? Like 3 miles to the town?
So right off the bat, one of my favorites is Jimmy, who's the youngest.
Oh my God, Jimmy. I love Jimmy.
He has this incredible quote where he goes, I think we're all going to die here.
I wrote that down too.
And then, I'm just so like, funny. All right, so Jimmy's going to do well.
My favorite is there's this black kid from Chicago named DK. And he, I forgot exactly what his quote was, but I just fucking love him. He said something like, I didn't say anything like this in Chicago before. Yeah. He's trying to go to the desert. I think Mike is a freeloading douchebag. Remember, this kid's like 10, so.
He's one of the leaders, yeah.
I fucking hate him. And then actually, I think a early front runner for me who I like is, I really like Greg, because I think it's hysterical that Greg's 15, bigger, stronger, probably smarter than everyone.
Yeah.
And they try to make him out as like the bully, but he's clearly not a bully. His level. No. And he has a conflict with Mike right away, and I fucking hate Mike. So like, that's part of the reason I like him so much.
Yeah. And one of the leaders, Madison, I really like too, because every other leader on the first night was just bawling their eyes out, and she was just picking up the pieces.
Yeah, she's a natural born leader.
Yeah,
it's funny that they just chose random people to lead. Okay, so then let's get into when they actually get into the town. Mm-hmm. I know you have a favorite part when they're cooking dinner. Talk about that.
So the first night they get to town and they have to do all of this like physical labor, and then they're all really tired and really hungry. So they're like, okay, let's make dinner. And remember, these are children who have to cook for 40 people, which I would have a lot of trouble cooking for 40 people. And so they decide they're going to make pasta. They get this huge vat of water and put it on the stove, and it's not boiling, and they're like looking at this water and they're like, oh, I think that's fine. So they just dump boxes and boxes and boxes of pasta in there, and of course it never cooks. And so then they just have like a chunk of like hard pasta, and one of the kids gets so frustrated that I can't even remember who it was.
Sophie, I'm pretty sure. Sophia.
Oh, was it Sophia?
Yeah, the only one who knew how to cook.
Yeah, so she just takes this pot of their only food, their pasta, and just jumps it on the ground because she's so frustrated.
It was really funny.
All the kids are sitting in the mess hall just waiting for this pasta, like crying. And it,
yeah.
Oh.
And then I love when she finally takes charge and makes the pasta for everyone. And then it's like the slimiest, most disgusting looking thing ever. And my favorite kid, DK, makes the most disgusted looking face at her ever. It was so funny.
Yeah. Ugh.
And then so the very next day, the four leaders had to go to like some cabin thing, and they were told they had to split the people up into four districts. And then my favorite part is AJ literally just took like all the 15-year-olds, and he took this kid Alex, who's 8. I fucking love Alex. Alex Wade, great guy.
Yeah, Alex is good too.
Yeah, he's great. Taylor and Dupree, she takes all like the 8-year-olds. So we've created a 4-way split, which I think is hysterical, because you're already splitting people up. You know, tribalist people are. 4 districts. This is gonna turn into some fucking crazy shit.
Yeah.
And then the next thing that's great is they create soul. Hey, my camera came on.
Nice. Finally.
Yeah. Hey. Okay. So then the next greatest part is that they literally created social classes for these people. And like, so the upper class, which they literally call the upper class, gets $1 to spend, and they can do whatever they want. Then the next class is the merchant class. Right. And they get 20, mm-hmm. they get 50 cents. Below that's the cooks. They get 25 cents. And then you have the lowest class, which are basically the laborers, basically. And they get like 10 cents. So not only have you divided these people by district, but then you divide them by social class and how much money they have.
Yeah.
Which is a recipe for disaster. And how they decide this is they have a competition where it's like, they have to get these oil rig things, and like put them on the tube and pump the water out. And whoever fills the most bottles first gets to be first class, second class, whatever. And somehow AJ's team, which had all like the 15-year-olds, fucking got second place. And Mike got first place. And I fucking hate Mike. Is rigged.
Mike is just like, can't take it. He just has like a meltdown.
You know, I fucking hate Mike. Remember, this kid's 8.
And he's then 8?
Or no, maybe he's like 10. He's not that old. No, yeah. you know, he's not 10 because he's the youngest one's 10. He's probably like 11 or 12.
Yeah.
And so basically, if they all finish within an hour, they get like a special reward for everyone. And the fucking like little children barely made it. And that would have meant that they missed out on getting extra toilets. They had to choose if they wanted toilets or a TV. And I was thinking, like, if these people choose a TV, I'm going to fucking lose my mind. Because imagine 40 people have to poop or pee at the same time.
Yeah.
That's a nightmare. They have 8 toilets now.
Yeah. And also, like, you have 40 people huddling around one TV, like...
Yeah.
There's a lot more things to be done also.
Also, they're not going to watch it. They have to literally cook and survive.
Yeah. They're not going to have any time.
Yeah. And then my favorite thing that Sophia said is, I feel like I'm often surrounded by a bunch of dumb people, and I totally resonate with that quote.
Yeah. Sophia is just like a champion. She should have been one of the leaders.
She should have been. I know. She's the best. She actually knows how to cook. And then,
some of the kids too are like, you know, used to live on a farm or still do live on a farm, and they know how to milk goats or like, you know, get the eggs from the chickens or something. So
yeah, so some of them are useful. Another great thing that happened is, so Jimmy wants to leave, right? Mm-hmm. And these kids from like the deep south are like, I know how we can get change his mind. Let's go jackrabbit hunting. So I'm like an 8-year-old who wants to see his family. I think a really traumatizing thing would be beating a jackrabbit with a stick. Yeah. I think that would be more traumatizing than wanting to stay.
That is absolutely traumatizing.
And then, unfortunately, Jimmy decided to go back home. And all I'd say is, I imagine Jimmy fucking regrets that so much. Because imagine the stories he could tell people going forward. If
he would be absolutely traumatized, though.
He would be. But, like, just do it for the stories. The stories he'd have the rest of his life would have been insane if he spent 40 days in an abandoned mine town making the laws with other children.
Ugh, I know. But when you're 8, like, that's just...
It's a lot.
Too much. It's too much.
Yeah. And then to recap the episode, Sophia won the 20... Oh, yeah. So you get 20K, all right, via Gold Star. So she won $20,000.
Yeah.
And her parents were, like, so ecstatic. I don't know what her deal is, but I think that was actually like a potentially life-changing amount of money. So like, good for them.
Yeah, seriously.
I like Sophia. All right, so that's done with talking about the show. But let's talk about the premise. What fucking parents would just be like, you know what's a good idea? Let's let our kids go live in New Mexico and make their own laws for 40 days. Who the fuck thought that? Who signed off on that?
I mean, yeah. I remember, because Steve and I went to college together, mm-hmm. and our first semester of college, we were in London, and a lot of us hadn't been away from home for that long before. And I kind of feel like it's that on a massive scale. Like,
yeah. The only difference is they're not drinking, like, alcohol and doing stupid stuff like we were.
Yeah. Like, I was 18 years old, and... had trouble taking care of myself at that point, dropped into a foreign country. So
I ate
can't imagine
pasta kids. Every single fucking meal. And then I'd buy lunch. I'd have eggs for breakfast, and I'd have chicken and pasta for dinner. And then I'd have a sandwich that I'd purchase.
I remember you made a lot of carbonara.
A lot of carbonara. I only made it once. I made a big batch though. One time. I made like raviolis a lot, and that was a good time. London was a great time. But yeah, no, I mean, like, that was a shit show, and we were like adults.
Yeah.
Literally. You're talking about 8-year-olds and 15-year-olds. That's a fucking shit show. That's a shit storm waiting to happen. And like, the crazy thing too is, if it was like people when they're 13 and like hormonal and stuff,
are so mean.
Yeah.
It could. I mean, we haven't seen. I've only watched episode one, but I have a feeling this is going to end in disaster, and I'm so excited.
Something I'm just thinking about is I wonder if there will be some, like, romance blossoming.
I was thinking that, too. I mean, Greg is 15. Sophia is, like, 14. I mean,
yeah.
I don't really want to see that because they're minors, but, like,
I bet some of them have like a crush on someone.
Oh, definitely. Like, definitely.
I wonder if that's going to be part of it.
I wonder. I'm excited to find out. But like, seriously though, it just seems like a really bad idea. I feel like there could be some inappropriate things taking place.
There would be even more drama if it was like ages 13 to 17 or something.
Yeah, but like, what if a 17-year-old like hooked up with a 13-year-old? That'd be really fucked up.
Yeah, but no, I don't think that would happen just because they're in the same.
Yeah, I think it's funnier though having them not have learned about how governments work yet. Though I makes it so great.
Yeah. Or like how to do anything.
Basic chores and stuff. Yeah, no. I'm a fan of the show, though. It's going to be a recurring segment, so you better fucking watch with us because you're not going to want to miss out. Please feel free to engage with us about this on social media because I think it's a great show. I want to keep doing this.
Yep.
And yeah, so I guess we're going to wrap up now. So stay tuned on this Wednesday. We're recording a special episode with the Geesebumps podcast. I believe we're going to be on their podcast. We're going to go on to Kian's podcast at some point. And yeah, so look out for those. And again, it's Wide Atlantic Weird is his podcast name. Is it at Irish Podcast? Let me check what it's called. What his handle is.
I think it's Strange Ireland.
Yeah, Strange Ireland. And yeah, it's at Strange Ireland is his handle on Twitter. I believe it's just Wide Atlantic Weird. Check out our friends at Geesebumps. They're really fun. I love their show. They did a recent episode, a little different, where they read some joke books that R.L. Stein wrote under the pseudonym Jovial Bob. And it's a hoot and holler. It's a good time. Yeah, and the more of you that listen, I guess the more I'll tell you about childhood traumas like yeah, the more people that listen, hey, if we can get 1,000 listeners an episode and we start making some real money on our ads, I'll tell you more about weird childhood traumas I had. Maybe then you'll find out why I'm afraid of swimming.
That's enticing.
Yeah. I already told you guys about Charlie Brown. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, make sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @podcast_misfits. We have a blog. Check out our blog. We write blogs. It's misfitsandmysteries.com. Please like, subscribe, rate our podcast. All that stuff's really helpful for the algorithm getting found. Also, this is something that that I know that Kian says on his podcast is word of mouth is really helpful. So if you're enjoying our show, please just like tell someone that you know, even if it doesn't have to be through like Twitter or social media. If you have a friend you think would like this, please just tell them to check us out because I think that would be super helpful. And the more eyes we get, the better. We really appreciate the support. We just got 300 followers today on Twitter. We really appreciate the support you guys are giving us. We get a lot of positive feedback and we appreciate it. If it was anything you would like us to do or any segment you think works particularly well, please let us know so we can keep that and fine tune things. We want to make the best product possible.
Absolutely. Well, stay spooky, everybody.
Stay spooky and have a nice week. I guess short week for some of you with Veterans Day. All right. Bye.
Storybox Audio.